My best and brightest student was so into it. And she was sitting in front of me the whole time. And on the last day of the retreat, finally, your vow of silence is broken. At about 2 a.m, she climbs up to the roof of the retreat center and jumps off headfirst and lands about 5 feet from where I was sleeping.
Shut up. It's another episode of On the Edge with Andrew Gold. I don't need to tell you that, because the way audio podcasts work is that you have to really know the name of my podcast and search for it and find it, rather than, you know, some sort of online discovery where you end up clicking on it and might not be fully aware of the name of the show. In any case, I've wasted a good 15 seconds saying absolutely nothing, and that is the show. No, hopefully there's a lot more interesting things to come. In fact, there definitely are, because Scott Carney's on the podcast, and he is a fascinating man who's written quite a few books, and I think I'll get him on to talk about a few of his other experiences. He's one of those journalists who's really immersive and really goes and finds out about their topic and gets involved in it. And this one is about death by meditation. And it's pretty insane. When he told me about this story, I was just like, yeah, this is an On the Edge topic, 100%. Really, really fascinating and scary. And it just shows what can happen when people are competing for status. It reminds me some of this of the Heaven's Gate cult, for example, where they ended up all killing themselves to ascend to a higher spiritual plane or whatever it might be. So meditation can also be, you know, scary and worrying. Like anything else, I think for the vast majority of people, it's not, of course, and it's really helpful for a lot of people, including Scott, who I believe practices it, or he was a teacher of it at some point. So I hope you enjoy this episode. I've got interesting ones coming up as well about revenge porn and another one about sex trafficking. So it's all getting quite edgy, and it's a move away from some of the Scientology and royal stuff of late, just to sort of mix the podcast up a little bit. I hope you guys enjoy that. But now, you're on the edge of meditation cults and how they can kill you with Scott Carney. But let's maybe start, Scott, with what meditation is, and we'll lead into the dark stuff, you know, a bit after that. So what actually is meditation?
That's a fascinating question, and it's like one of those questions that you just can't answer, right? There are many different types of meditation. The Buddha taught several. There's Hindu meditation. There's even Christian meditation. It's all over the place. But the idea is, it is a way to look inside, to see what is happening in your body by focusing on your sensations, on your breathing, on mantras, and it's a way to turn your consciousness in a way to understand what your consciousness is all about. It's a way to look at yourself.
Can that work on everyone? Because I feel like my cousin loves it. He teaches meditation. He's really on it, and he's a good. We're very close as well, and I've just never. I my head can't seem to even start with it. You know.
I mean, again, it is such a broad term. You know, whether you're we could be meditating right now by talking with each other, but just by looking at each other, depending what teacher you ask. And you know, there's the typical one where you're in that lotus position and you got your hands like on your knees. Like, that's what most people think of as meditation. But you could also meditate. I know I wrote a book on called What Doesn't Kill Us about jumping into ice water and then controlling your emotions in ice water. That's also a meditation because you're focused on the inside. It's really what you're trying to get out of meditation, which is what is a more interesting question. Like, why are you doing it? Are you doing it to become a better, more well-adjusted person and, you know, sort of control your emotions? Are you trying to get superpowers and levitate off your cushion and shoot lasers out of your eyeballs? Some people do that. Or are you, you know, what are you doing with your meditation? That is the real question. It is a technique, or it is a variety of techniques to look inside and gain mastery over your body and mind.
Uh-huh. So it's sort of, I guess the closest I get to it is if I hurt myself, or I know that you've talked about having canker sores, which we call mouth ulcers in the UK. I get really bad ones as well, like my mouth explodes with them. And I'm sort of telling myself like, hey, it's all in your mind. This is not a real thing. Just get on with it. Is that the closest thing I do to meditation?
I don't think that's going to work to get rid of your mouth ulcers. I don't think you could just like think at your mouth ulcers to get rid of them. But yes, that would be a type of meditation if that's what you were doing. I just don't think it would be an effective type to do that. You know, we can get into the physiology of different types of meditations if you'd like. You have a sympathetic nervous system, which is fight or flight, and you have the parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest. And in general, most meditation is trying to get you deep into that rest and digest phase, trying to get you deep into that hard relaxation while remaining aware as you do it. But again, the term meditation is too big to say what exactly we're talking about here.
I actually, what you've just said sort of makes sense to me. It's sort of tapping into, it's like you're hacking the system a little bit. I like that. Tell me, I want to get into the darkness. Let's get into some of this dark stuff. So you wrote this book. Am I right in saying after hearing about the case of Ian Thorson?
Yes, the case of Ian Thorson is what started it. But the origin moment actually happens way back in 2005 for me when I was leading an abroad program in North India with a bunch of American college students. And, you know, I had lived in India at that point for, I think, about 3 years. I speak Hindi. I speak some Tibetan. Wow. I'd lived in Tibet for a little while. And I know a lot about the Indic traditions of meditation. You know, ideas of using mantras, which are sort of like words, Sanskrit words or Tibetan words to, you know, focus your mind. And in Tibetan meditation, you're also looking at goddesses and you're thinking about or gods, and you're also thinking about your body becoming a god. It's very esoteric stuff. It's a very specific and intense type of meditation. And I took these students onto a silent meditation retreat in the Tibetan tradition, which is called Lam Rim, the introductory steps to enlightenment. And we were going to be totally quiet. And although I was the program director, I was not teaching the meditation. I was just one of the students for this component. And we were totally silent. And in these traditions, being silent lets you go inside. You want to reduce the stimulus of the outside world so that you really have time to explore where your mind goes inside of these practices. And after 7 days, you know, I was sitting in the back, and I'm actually not very good with silence. I want to be, I want to talk about my ideas, and it was really a struggle for me to get into it. But my best and brightest student, a woman named Emily O'Connor, was so into it, and she was sitting in front of me basically this whole time. And on the last day of the retreat, you know, your vow of silence is broken, and so you can start talking. And I'm sitting with all the other kids and being like, "Oh my God, I had all these realizations and things like that." And she just sort of went off to the side and wanted to like go introspective. I go to bed, and at about 2 a.m, she's been writing in her journal her ideas. She climbs up to the roof of the retreat center at the Root Institute in Bodh Gaya and jumps off headfirst and lands about 5 feet from where I was sleeping. And
shut up.
And I get up, and I see her corpse in the blue moonlight. And I am suddenly responsible for figuring out what happened to her and bringing her corpse back to the United States. It is the most traumatic, difficult thing I've ever been in. It was the instigating moment for all of the books I've written since then. And her, you know, the first thing I do is, you know, after dealing with the cops and there's a murder investigation initially, it's a really intense event. I grab her journal.
Wow.
And I read, you know, her thoughts and what it goes is from this normal student experience in India, you know, oh my God, there's cows on the road. Oh, I'm having some spiritual insights, you know, the normal sort of surface layer stuff. To the moment we get into the retreat center, she starts realizing in herself that she has connection to these scriptures. She understands death and nirvana and bliss at a very deep level. And she realizes that she needs to end her life and leave her body at that moment in order to get to the next level of realizations. And the last words in her journal are, "I am a bodhisattva," which means It's a Tibetan version of an angel. The idea of a bodhisattva is this realized being who is enlightened and decides to stay on Earth and help every other sentient being get enlightened instead of going towards nirvana, which is sort of a cessation moment, a sort of the Buddhist heaven you could call nirvana. And I was just profoundly shocked. And I mean, this is, I'm a 27-year-old guy at this point. I'm pretty young. You know, I speak Hindi. I've done some interesting things, but this is really hard for me because the idea for meditation in that tradition is that you're trying to learn how to become a better person, become better adjusted to experience bliss and all these positive emotions. How did that transform into such a traumatic and terrible thing where someone takes their own life? And this is what set me off on my career as an investigative journalist in general, and is the genesis point for the book, The Enlightenment Trap, where I tried to understand how meditation can go so terribly wrong.
Scott, I didn't expect that twist halfway through, and I realize now that saying shut up wasn't the right thing to say, but I just was so shocked, and I didn't mean for you to actually shut up, but that's absolutely insane. To what extent do you think she is speaking when she or writing abstractly? Is it, you know, to what extent is this like, okay, all everything is one and I want to be this sort of righteousness being or whatever, and to what extent is it just like, Does she really know that she's just going to be dead when she dies? You know, that's what I mean. I've asked that in a bad way, but you know what I mean?
No. I think that those are very good questions. You should also add another question on there. Was she a bodhisattva, right? Let's ask the three questions. And yes, she knew she was going to die, because the passages right before that sort of discuss how horrible and painful this process is going to be, but she has to get through it. And so she knew that her moment was going to be a difficult transition from life to death, and she was aware of that, as far as I can interpret from her writings. I mean, any writing can have sort of a variety of interpretations. You can read her words in my book, The Enlightenment Trap, to make up your own mind. But she had come to the point to realize, and this is a real problem in religious teachings, and especially meditative teachings, is that they teach you that there's the real world that we live in, the normal world where of cause and effect, where if I pick up a glass of water, I drink this glass of water, and it was because I was thirsty. In the Tibetan tradition, it was actually because of my karma. My past lives made me feel that sensation of thirst at that moment, and it's actually all connected to this other reality, a truer reality that we cannot see and we can only access through meditation. This is the danger. It's called spiritual bypassing. It's the idea that there's a spiritual explanation for everything that happens in the real world that you can't detect with science. You can only detect with introspection. And she believed her own life was not real and the meditative experience was real. And many, many traditions teach that. I mean, think about in the Christian tradition, right, where people do insane things like a crusade and they murder bunches of people because they know that the real reality is heaven and they're going to this perfect place. And in the Tibetan traditions and the Hindu traditions and many meditative traditions, that is the same thing. So when she took her life, she didn't think it was going to be the end of a journey. She thought she would be reborn a bodhisattva immediately. And
so,
you know,
genuinely, she really, like, concretely, she thought that.
Concretely. I mean, it's in the text. And then, you know, I spent the next year asking two questions. And one was because I had to, so I wrote this book on organ trafficking called The Red Market, which is really sort of the first book that was about that, you know, where I become an investigative journalist and people really know what I do. And one of the things that I noticed first with dealing with her body is that once she had left it, you know, once you die, your body becomes the property and ownership of other people. And they, you know, they move your body through various ways. And I found in India, people were wanting pieces of her body for different things through funerary traditions and police investigations. There's a whole organ trafficking thing that happens in India, although that wasn't her particular case. That led me down this rabbit hole of investigating organ trafficking, where I, you know, found how people buy and sell human body parts and all this very physical part of death. And that became a central part of my early career, writing for Wired and NPR and all those people. Then the other thing that was going on in my mind is, how can somebody take their own life in pursuit of bliss. And so I've talked to holy men throughout North India, both in the Hindu and the Tibetan traditions. I asked her, well, what was she a bodhisattva? Is there an Ur reality, Ur meaning like a super reality, that is more real than this world? And had she found it? And all of the lamas that I spoke to, you know, guys in robes who've been studying meditation for 10 years or 20 years or, you know, 30 years, all said, no, she wasn't. She had gone crazy. And it's a very common thing in the Tibetan tradition to have a condition called lung, which means wind. And, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, you have these chakras. Maybe you've heard of the spinning wheels of energy in your body. It is a separate body to your own body. It's not your kidneys and your intestines and your heart. You have this like sort of like energy channels called nadis that go through your body. And what they say in this spiritual anatomy is that you can get those chakras can eventually essentially become a hurricane where everything's out of whack and you go crazy. And interestingly enough, Westerners are very, very susceptible to the Tibetan medical condition called lung. And it's because we always want to achieve things. In meditation, you want to like zen out. You want to zen out, right? That's a meditation phrase. You want to get into yourself and you want to like let your ego go. But Americans, British, and anyone who was raised on Return of the Jedi or, Eddie Murphy's The Golden Child, we have this idea that if you go to the East, right, if you ditch your own corrupt Christian traditions, because we all know there's problems with Christianity, right, and you go East, you will find someone who has figured out the spiritual perfection, and they're going to be in the Himalayas for some reason. And we have that, you know, Batman, and Batman Begins. He goes into Tibet and he finds a blue lotus and then he learns Kung Fu. I don't know how that all connects, but it does. Like, the Jedi is chosen. Yoda is modeled on the Dalai Lama. The Ewoks speak high speed Tibetan. This is all true, right? We have romanticized the East and we conflate it with superhero-dom. And when you're meditating, a lot of us are meditating because we want to become enlightened. This idea of like, oh my God, the enlightened master, they can do things like a Jedi, walk through walls, read minds, these various things that are actually mentioned in the yogic traditions. If you read Patanjali's The Yoga Sutras, they're called siddhis, which means miracles. And there are things that you can supposedly get through meditation. You learn these siddhis and then you can do, you know, super hearing, super resistance to cold, levitation, these sorts of things are in the Yoga Sutras. And then we're like, oh my God, I can meditate my way to becoming a Jedi. But the problem is that there's a cultural translation problem going on. It's like if someone had never heard of Christianity and they're like, hey, that Jesus guy was amazing. I love the idea that I could duplicate fishes. I could make some wine. I could raise myself from the dead. And that is what they fixate on. It's all the miracles and not the actual teachings. And that's what so many Americans and Westerners do when they go East. They come with this idea of I can work hard. And if I work hard, I will achieve these goals. And it's this like toxic mix of belief, cultural misunderstandings, and also weird history that happened in Tibet in the medieval era that we could, I guess, go into if you want to.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, what I'm thinking of while you're speaking is obviously I've done a lot of episodes for this channel about cults and things, and there are a lot of parallels and just things, and maybe some of these are unfair stereotypes that I have of some parts or extreme parts of meditation communities, is just as with religions and cults, you have this sort of competitive modesty, competitive virtue, or like I can not care about anything superficial even more than everyone else, and you have all these things, and what you were saying about how she wanted to ascend to the next life felt like Heaven's Gate. Have you given that much thought, the Heaven's Gate cult?
Sure. I'm Heaven's Gate. I'm writing about Geshe Michael Roach's group called Diamond Mountain. I mean, all of them have different ways that they spiritually bypass, right? But they all share the idea that there are rules to the world that are not to be determined through science. They're to be determined by revelation and hearing someone else's revelation, right? You know, because I didn't have the revelation, but this guy, and they're usually guys, right? This guy did know what it was. And I believe him because, and this is the super interesting and the really important thing that everyone gets wrong about cults, is that when you start, when you join the cult, life gets better. Almost always. Like, you have a need, you know, maybe you're disconnected from society, maybe you have a mental illness or a depressive tendencies, financial problems, whatever it is, you have a problem. And when you first join the cult, your life gets better. There's people saying that they like you, they're listening to you, and other people don't listen to you. And you genuinely learn good things. And with meditation, it's very well established that when you start meditating, you get better attention, your health often gets better, you become more aware of yourself, and that makes you feel good. I mean, this is what we call the law of diminishing returns, or what I call it, the law of speedy gains. It's the same idea. You take up a new practice and you get better rapidly. And as we do that, as you get into this thing, you're learning their meditation technique, you're watching your body change, and when you're meditating, time speeds up, it slows down, you sort of realize that these cool things are going on in you that you've never bothered to look at before, and everything gets better. It's only then, after you've had that speedy gain, you know, with the law of diminishing returns, there's that tapering off, and then they sort of sell you this thing, which is like, and I can make that gain keep going up if you sign up for my course, if you double down on my tantric teachings. I don't remember exactly what Heaven's Gate used as an upsell, but it ended up with them realizing the Hale Bop was going to come and they're going to get levitated into the comet, right? That's that wearing Nike sneakers. And once you sort of buy into the more crazy ideas, like the more abstract that organization is, you realize that you've actually become isolated from the community at large. You have this weird idea, whatever it might be, right? Electrical signals are controlling my mind, for instance. And if you tell someone else that, or, you know, they're going to be like, that's weird. And you're like, well, and that feels like a negative thing. You're like, they don't understand the true reality that I understand. And this, like, this accelerates your accepting everything that cult leader says. Is that what if you're in for a penny, in for a pound, and you can start accepting more and more things. And one of the dangers in the Tibetan traditions is that they have those upsells, right? You learn meditation and your body becomes better, you become more aware, and there's all this like good stuff and all these promises that they offer you, but it's also really hard. And your beliefs also get a little weird. You're like, okay, you know, the goddess Tara is doing this to me right now, and I'm learning that everyone else around me has a karmic lesson they're giving to me. But if you start explaining karma to somebody who's not a Tibetan Buddhist, they're like, wait, what are you talking about? Like, you got thirsty because in your karma in previous lives, you didn't drink enough water or whatever that karmic thing happens. And you the reaction of an individual is to become more intense in that community, not to draw themselves out and be like, wait a minute, maybe I need to take a step back and think if my ideas are really rational or not.
There's always another level, isn't there? Just another level, whether even just multi-level marketing, Scientology, things like that. And you're absolutely right that, I mean, Scientology, some of the teachings they have that don't involve Lord Zeno and things like that, they're helpful for a lot of people. They're like, you know, you're in control of your life. You pulled it in. They say, you know, whatever happens to you, that's not great advice for a lot of people, but for some people, the ones who join it, just it's just right for their lives in that particular moment, makes them happy, and they keep you keep ascending. You're regaining in status, I suppose, with the people in your community you care about. But then these things happen. Hey, when that happened, when she jumped off the roof, I know, like, as a journalist myself as well, you get caught up. You're writing these books, and they become sort of book subjects and things like that. But on an emotional level, for you, witnessing that, that must have hit hard. What was that like?
Witnessing her die?
Yeah.
It was devastating. I mean, it was a moment in my life where it was the turning point in many ways, because one, it was a turning point for, you know, I was a meditator, right? I there are things about it that I liked. I mean, I wasn't on the sort of tantric crazy side, but it made me aware that not everyone's promises are real. And then dealing with who was my, you know, she was my favorite student in the group. She was driven. She was the, we had students who were more flighty, who were talking about it like Atlantis and their own spiritual insights. And I was like, you're just crazy. And like those people ended up being more resilient, interestingly enough, because their ideas were so out there that they weren't going to be taken by just one idea and make that control their life. She was the one who was like, so driven, straight A student, studied yoga at home, had the perfect lotus posture. She was someone who could follow the rules. And then when the rules told her to go a certain direction, she was going to triple and quadruple down. And that's a fascinating thing about this. It's that you don't expect the most together person to be the one who goes all in on this. But all you need to do is just switch some of your fundamental understandings about the world, just like 10 degrees. And that type A person goes down the road of madness, much more so than the person who's just, you know, takes everything at once and just is like, yeah, I'll take a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that was shocking to me. Of course, dealing with the police investigation, dealing with the autopsy, dealing with those things are very, very visceral. And it made me really understand a lesson in death that I had not ever had to face before. And I think that actually some good things have come out of that for me. I mean, there's also this idea called a bodhisattva in the Tibetan tradition. Is there could be bodhisattva, the 10,000-armed Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig or one of these like god-type bodhisattvas, with a capital B, but there is also the idea of like a small B bodhisattva, like just somebody who is there for you at your time in life and is able to help you and guide you in your own life. And I do think that perhaps there is an argument to be made that Emily's death taught me, you know, a lot about living and dying and spreading this message about like some of the insanity of meditation. There are good things that can come out of it. I mean, life is not only a great, I don't look at her and think that she was just a horrible person for having done this. I think she made a terrible error. And I think that spreading these messages is very, very important for the health of meditators everywhere. So in that sense, in that specific sense, she was sort of a bodhisattva. And I think that maintaining this sort of understanding about things is very healthy and very useful, because nothing in the world is black and white. Nothing is like a definite answer. And also, I don't know what happens when we die. You don't know what happens when we die. There are things that science cannot answer because we don't have the tools and maybe we'll never be able to answer. And I think that there are that mystery is very important. It's part of the interesting thing about being alive and being a human. And there's nothing wrong to ask those questions. What is wrong is you know, is when asking those questions leads to bad effects in your life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And did her family, did Emily's family get in touch? Did you ever worry if people might, you know, you were the teacher there, did you feel that people might hold you perhaps unfairly responsible in some way?
Oh, of course. I mean, that was, you know, I remember writing in a journal or a letter at that time that the difference between a hero and a villain is just a matter of perspective. I mean, they could have easily have said that I caused her death, which I didn't. But, you know, it's a very emotionally difficult point. And I certainly have had many, many communications with her family, although I don't talk about those things on the record.
No, I understand. Okay. Well, we don't need to. But absolutely. Yeah, I'm flabbergasted, really. It's not, I mean, I actually got in touch with you to talk about, you know, you mentioned it before, the body stuff and the stealing of organs and things like that. And then you mentioned this, and it's just something I had no idea about. So you then got on to tell me the story of Ian Thorson.
Right. So I always knew that I wanted to write about Westerners who go to India and go crazy. Right. After this moment when she died, I was like, I need to dig into this question. But I didn't want to write only about her. I wanted to look into the broader experiences of people. So I spent, in this year that I was looking at interviewing lamas, I was also collecting journals of other people who had died on meditation retreats or gone crazy. And I found one doctor in Delhi who said that he admits about 100 patients a year with what is called India syndrome. They go to India and they learn that they're Shiva, or they learn that they're Krishna or Buddha, and then they go crazy and they end up in a mental institution. So it's not just thinking you're crazy, you actually end up diagnosed with this. And there are about 100 people at that point per year ending up in institutions. And having lived in India for a long time, I have met many people who are on that road. You know, people who are totally spiritual bypassing every time, but maybe didn't end up at the clinical level. And as I was, you know, researching that, I got a letter from someone, I forget who, saying that Ian Thorson had just died on a 3-year meditation retreat in the Arizona desert under the tutelage of this man named Geshe Michael Roach, who is a white Tibetan Buddhist teacher. Geshe is the equivalent of a PhD in Tibetan Buddhism issued by Tibetan universities. And he was a white guy who went to India, learned some Tibetan and Sanskrit, studied then in New Jersey, and was tasked with bringing Tibetan Buddhism to the United States, to the West, and teaching it in accessible American English. Like, when you're talking to a Tibetan monk, things get very esoteric very quickly. It was actually useful to have a white guy teaching these concepts, but he was also very captivated by an experience of enlightenment that he found when in his teen years, when he saw himself floating above the earth and realizing he was responsible for all sentient beings, basically realizing he was a bodhisattva, just like my student. And then he made this huge religious movement in Arizona. Roach took and this happens very frequently, he took a young, hot, 20-something-year-old woman who he realized was really not only sexy, but also probably enlightened herself. And they had lots of enlightened sex together on a 3-year silent meditation retreat in the desert as they translated Tibetan texts from medieval manuscripts into English, and then realized that they were sort of on the path themselves. So he goddessed, that's a verb, he goddessed this woman, and they taught on stage together, white guy in red robes, white girl in white robes, teaching yoga and meditation and Tibetan Buddhism. And it was all mixed together around the same time as the Tibetan Freedom Concert in the late mid, what was that, 96, I want to think, maybe 98. Maybe later, I don't know, the timeline's a little off on me right now. And then, as their group grows larger and larger, and they buy some land in Arizona on a old Apache area, a sacred area for the Apache, they, after you've been having sex with your student for a while, you might realize, when you are a Tibetan Lama or an enlightened cult leader, you might realize that, hey, these other ladies are also goddesses too. So he sort of decided to sideline his goddess and tried to go get with these other ladies. And they had planned to do another silent meditation retreat together with, I think, 30 people in the desert. And he had to, like, kick the woman that he'd brought up, Lama Christy McNally, he had to kick her over to someone else. And he sort of like arranged a marriage with Ian Thorson, who is the guy who eventually ended up dying in the desert. And Roach left the retreat. You know, this sounds like a soap opera. It's really funny to sort of go into the minute details here. But Roach leaves the retreat.
Well, the Netflix series. This isn't the same one as there was a Netflix series in like Oregon
Wild
or
Country.
Something. Do you know what it?
Yeah, that's Osho. That's Wild. No, a different group. There's tons of these scandals. Wild Wild Country is a great documentary. You should watch it. But the problem with Wild Wild Country is it just said, hey, look at all these crazy incidents that are happening, but not why people would be so captivated by Osho, who is truly a captivating person. But to get back to Roach and McNally, Roach goes off. He decides not to do his 3-year silent meditation retreat. Christy McNally and Ian Thorson, who are now married and lovers, do go into the mountains. And she, because we're already off book, right? We had the guy, the Tibetan guy, the white guy who actually studied Tibetan. And then we had this Christy McNally person who's like, well, I need to make my own brand of this Tibetan Buddhism. So she starts borrowing from the Hindu canon and starts adding a goddess named Kali. Kali is the violent goddess of war, death, and destruction in the Hindu pantheon. And, you know, if you see a picture of her, she's got 6 arms and like a knife in one hand and a severed head in the other hand. She's a mean lady. And Hindus do worship her, but they worship her at a distance. They're a little scared about bringing her. You don't hang a picture of Kali on your wall. It's generally a bad idea. It brings bad luck. She then performs these meditations where they, you know, as I mentioned before, you sort of imagine yourself as beings, as goddesses, and you while you're sitting there in a perfect meditation pose, you imagine that your body is the goddess Kali. You've got these arms. You try to think what those arms feel like to have those arms. You think about what it's like to hold the severed head of a god in your hand. And kind of, you really try to embody those feelings and rage and tantra. And the idea in tantra is that instead of just calming yourself, as you do in like the meditation that most of us think of, in tantra you try to inflame those feelings, inflame all of the emotions, and through that building up of emotions, you can go through and get enlightened faster. It's the quicker way to enlightenment. So she's doing this with her then husband, her new husband, and they start practicing a dual meditation where she pretends she's Kali, and I don't remember who he thinks he's thinking he is at that time. And they take out a knife and they start knife fighting, and she stabs her husband, Ian Thorson, in the chest right here. And, you know, she's also...
Inside.
Huh? And she's also, you know...
In the side. Yeah.
In the side, yeah. In the ribs, into the intercostals, yeah. And so, so at that point, this is a problem because your meditation teacher is also, you know, the one that's trying to get you to bliss is also stabbing her husband in a meditation. And sort of all hell breaks loose in that community. They do manage to, he doesn't die, right? They stitch him up. They find someone to stitch him up secretly. And then she teaches. So once every year, they'll come out and they'll teach what they've learned on their meditations. So that she comes out in a blindfold in front of the broader community. There's 100 or 200 people in the audience. And she teaches them. She starts telling everyone how she stabbed her husband in a meditation. And when this goes public, the Tibetan Buddhists out there are like, we got to get her out of there. And so Michael Roach kicks her out of the de-goddesses her again, makes her not a teacher. And she and Ian Thorson, who still have another year left on their meditation retreat, end up climbing up to the mountain above the retreat center and start meditating to continue their retreat in a remote cliff instead of like a hut with sort of, you know, people bringing them water and food. It goes south. They start drinking dirty water. She gets dysentery. He nurses her back to health. He gets dysentery and does very, very bad. He starts turning purple and white, and you know his colors are changing, and he's dying in front of her. And she has this decision to make. Do I use my cell phone and my personal locator spot beacon, you know, the thing you press the button and the helicopters come to pick you up? She could use that stuff to save his life, or she could use her holy powers to bring him out of his diseased state and save him with herself. And at that point, it wasn't only their lives on the line, but in her mind, it was their souls. Doesn't end well for Ian Thorson. About a day later, he's dead. And she does press the locator beacon, and the helicopters do come, and they remove his corpse. And this is the story that I had to dig into, because it had all of these elements of both Eastern spirituality, the search for superpowers, because they're also trying to they all thought they were Neo in the Matrix, essentially. They all thought that they were going to understand the fundamental nature of the universe and bring world peace and things like that. It had all of those elements of a classic, gripping cult narrative, but I could also bring in elements of Tibetan theology and try to teach people how captivating these ideas are and why someone would even want to get there. And so that's what the enlightenment trap is about. And if I'm going to define that word for you, enlightenment trap, what is it? Anyone who tells you they are trying to seek enlightenment or that they are enlightened is drastically misunderstanding what enlightenment is all about. Right? In the Sanskrit, Bodhi, which is enlightenment, really translates as wisdom. Right? It doesn't really translate as like a final state that you get to. But when enlightenment, that idea, comes to the West, it actually happens right after the Enlightenment, right? The idea in the Enlightenment, you know, you sort of go back and you find all these texts, right? Remember in the Enlightenment, in the Renaissance, this is what happens. You go in and you find these texts in Constantinople and in ancient Greece, and you rediscover the writings of Galen, you rediscover the writings of Aristotle, Socrates, and then there's this re-flourishing of that in the West. Enlightenment actually sort of hits Bodhi, the word Bodhi hits Europe around that same time that we're going through this. And the idea is that we can find the lost texts of the East and get a new enlightenment in the West. And it's a weird idea that how this word has made it to America and weighed it to the West. And we then conflated it with heaven. We conflated it with the idea that you can arrive here at a place. It is a place we get to. When in reality, enlightenment is a journey. It's a thing you try to accomplish. It's something you never reach. And anyone who reaches it is, in my opinion, by definition, insane. Right across the board, you don't get...
Or a fraud.
Yeah, or a fraud, which is sort of the same thing. But yeah, an outright fraud, or they're insane, or sometimes usually both. And you can never get... five enlightened people in a room, you know, we all understand the true nature of reality, and they never shake hands and agree, right? You never find eight cult leaders being like, oh yeah, you're totally right. This is how consciousness flows through the body. And that never happens. They all disagree because the nature of realization is all very individual and located in the individual. It's also the reason why everyone who's enlightened ends up having sex with their students, is because once you become enlightened, the trap is you don't have any peers anymore, right? You get to a point, and I'm the enlightened, when everything I say is perfect, and therefore no one can question you. You don't have any friends. No one's out there being like, well, is that really what the reality is? You're like, no, God tells me, or whatever like that. And so enlightenment in practice is a very isolating moment. And then usually it's men who end up in those places. There are a few women, but the men all then seem to realize that they are enlightened, and for some reason their penis was right the whole time. And that's why they have sex with all of their students. And they're like, oh, I feel these urges. And it's such a trap. It's so easy to get into, because sometimes these people start off actually really impressive, right? Michael Roach started off as a real scholar, as a person who was doing good in the world. And then at that moment that he had this realization that he was a bodhisattva, everything turned to madness. And then people flock to him because they want to hang out with the enlightened person. They want a person who has realized, because that is a goal, right? It's like, oh, if he did it, I can do it too. And it becomes this sick cycle where it's not only the cult leader who is responsible for this, but it's also the group that enables them.
It's like a culty version of The Intelligence Trap, which is a similarly named book by David Robson that just goes on that theory of the more intelligent you are, the more likely it is that you can go really far wrong because you're smart enough to convince yourself of your own cognitive biases. So you end up with, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes writer who believed in fairies and went really far with that and thought he could talk to all sorts of weird, you know, go on.
Yeah, well, he also, Arthur Conan Doyle, when Sherlock Holmes died, so he kills off Sherlock Holmes, and then he realized he has to write more books, and he brings Holmes back. Where did he go? He was in Tibet studying with the Tibetan lamas.
Oh, see, it's all linked together.
It's all linked.
I think it is this idea, I guess. Yeah, these people are, I mean, I also think they're just very arrogant. It's really arrogant people who are very intelligent and want to be the most enlightened. And then they can just convince themselves of anything. So I guess there's that cognitive dissonance because, like you say, they're just, you know, wherever their penis wants to go, it happens to, their mind is able to square that with their spiritual enlightenment.
Right.
At the same time, this woman, Lama Christy McNally, you know, she didn't want to use the locator thing to save Ian Thornton. But she was happy to use it the next day when he was dead to save herself in some respect, you know? So she's able to sort of square that with herself, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe a reality fell on her and she realized that her husband was dead in front of her. And this was actually something she couldn't reiki up out of nowhere. I also think that one thing is important to note here is that this isn't only a Western problem, right? In those traditions, in the Indic traditions, we have tons of charlatans who have shown up throughout the generations. And, you know, there's a guy named Drukpa Kunle, D-R-U-K-P-A space K-U-N-L-E-Y, who is, you know, went around Bhutan in the 1300s and basically told everyone he was enlightened and he had sex with all the nuns and all the king's daughters. And if you go to Bhutan today, you'll find his symbol painted on the walls of most houses. And his symbol, if you were to look it up and Google it, maybe you can put this up in your YouTube video, a picture of Drukpa Kunle's symbol. It is an erect phallus that is ejaculating white spooge all over the walls. This is a very common symbol throughout Bhutan. And it's clear just by looking at that, that this is the same thing as Michael Roach, just cast backwards into medieval Tibet. And we find this over and over again in all traditions. And I think that Westerners realize that there's problems in their own tradition, realize there's problems in Christianity, you know, sex abuse cases, you know, whatever you want to look at. And then you're like, well, there's got to be an answer somewhere else. And they look to another tradition and they start learning it. And then with any convert to any religion, those people are the most religious of anybody. This is a trend, is that the convert takes on everything and they become sort of fundamentalists. And this is what happens with Westerners who go east, who start learning those techniques. They try to, because they don't look Hindu or Tibetan, they sort of take on more of it. And they also don't realize that there's a whole history to the versions of Buddhism and Hinduism that they're going into. They don't realize that it's a constantly crunched tradition. They don't realize the endless sex scandals that have happened in Tibetan Buddhism. They don't realize that in the, I'm going to forget, I think it's 1200s. They don't realize that the Gelugpa sect, that's the Dalai Lama sect, decided that the Sakya sect, another version, was not good. So they called in the Mongols to massacre all of them. I mean, we don't realize that there's history in Tibet. We don't realize that, and we just think that it just must be what we imagine it to be. And then we look for that, and then we find our imagination.
Orientalism, I suppose it is, isn't it? This like idea that they're, you know, whether better or worse, they're like not human. And you have to realize they're human. They have the same problems that we do, the same issues and the same problems that we might have in Christianity or Judaism. I have that same thing. I'm Jewish and I've met over the years many people who converted to Judaism and they're always much more like into the whole thing and they know everything.
Yeah.
And you've got to like be careful like walking in their homes because you've got to make sure you haven't said the wrong thing and put the right dress on your head or wherever. Is the convert, isn't there an expression, beware the something of a convert? What is that?
It sounds like there should be, if there is not.
Yeah. I've just coined a thing. Beware the convert, I think. The zeal of the converts.
Yeah. Well, you look at this in ISIS, it's the same thing. All these people converted to a certain type of Islam, and it's the fundamentalist type of a certain version of Islam. And they're like, we are going to go all in. And the reality that we live in, you know, I'm sure that in ISIS utopia, you're not supposed to behead everyone you meet. But, you know, they enact this because they have a very specific reading of this. And, you know, this cultural misunderstanding happens in every culture, in every tradition. And it's even happening now in India where yoga started in India, obviously, and it was a very specific type of thing. And then it gets to the West and it's filtered through our Orientalism idea, right? And then it's re-exported back to India, where Indians are like, we're going to do this magical thing and we're going to rebrand it in an even more weird way. That's one thing that you happened with Osho. Osho is not true Indic religion, right? It is Indic religion that then's crunched through Western stuff in Oregon. Then he goes back to India and then reteaches this new repackaged Hinduism. The thing about culture and humanity is that culture is always borrowing. It's always appropriating from other people. And no one has like one claim to true authenticity. Even Tibetan Buddhism in the medieval period, this is like my favorite part of the book, and I'm just going to nerd out with you for a second, where I looked at how Tibetan Buddhism got so weird, because it's all about tantra, which is this really encountering, very magical, very symbolic type of Buddhism. And what happened is when Buddhism started in Tibet, it came over on the backs of an Indian monk who made it to Tibet and deposited some manuscripts in a Jaisangkhampa's archives. I think it was Tsongkhapa. Tsongkhapa didn't convert, but he was like, cool, thanks for the translations, and he translated it. And then eventually it sort of caught on, and it was the intro level Buddhism. It was the sutras. It was like, calm yourself and learn to be a good person, like the golden rule type Buddhism. And Tibetans were like, oh my God, I want more of this Buddhism stuff. So they started sending monks to India, and Tibet to India is a hard walk, right? Right now it's easy, but at that point you're going over the Himalayas, which is hard. Then there's tigers that are trying to kill you. Then there's bandits trying to kill you. And then you finally get to this monastery where they all hate you because they think you're a bumpkin, and you have to learn Sanskrit because all the texts are in Sanskrit, and that takes 7 years to learn. Okay, so this is a hard journey to do. So then you translate a couple books and you come back to Tibet. So let's say 10 years later, you're finally back, you got the books, and then you are the biggest New York Times best-selling monk in the world. They give you monasteries. You get to go around, you get to advise kings, and you're a big deal. So this happened there, and then they kept on sending monks, and then they ran out of texts. Like all the golden rule stuff disappeared, and then they're like, well, I need to get books that people want to read, or else this whole journey is worthless to me. And they started getting weirder and weirder texts. They started interviewing like the guy on the street corner who like, you know, charmed snakes and all of that stuff. And then it emerges from the magical traditions of India. You get this like sort of weird tantric Buddhism, and those become bestsellers in Tibet. And they're also able to upsell you. Like if you do 10,000 mantras and 20,000 prostrations, we'll teach you tantra. And then tantra becomes this big thing, which is how Tibet metastasizes into this weird religion, like this sort of like abstract, strange subset of Buddhism called Mahayana Buddhism. And then fast forward to the colonial area with the Brits. They've explored everywhere. At one point, they thought there were dragons over the next corner, but they went over the next corner, there were no dragons. They explored South America, no magic levitating people, nowhere. And then for the history of colonialism, the last place that the white guys reached was Tibet. And there's a geopolitical reason for that. And they all realized that if there were going to be levitating yogis, they were going to be somewhere, and they're going to be in the mountains. And they even looked at the old maps, Amerigo Vespucci, who's named for North and South America, had written on a map that Prester John, who is the lost apostle of Jesus, he's one of the three magi, Four magi? How many magi did Jesus get? The people who gave gifts with frankincense and myrrh to Jesus when he was born. Three magi, right? And
yeah.
When he came over, one of those guys' name was John, and he went back and founded his own Christian community somewhere to the east, but no one knew where it was. Amerigo Vespucci said it was there, and when the Westerners arrived in Tibet, they saw everyone in red robes, and they're like, this is the cult. This is the offspring of Prester John. It's the lost kingdom. And so there's all this spiritual idea of Tibet, and then you have this, the first people who start translating texts is the Theosophical Society. They are it's a woman named Madame Blavatsky and Annie Besant, and they are the magical traditions. And they're like, we will find these lost texts, we will translate them ourselves. And they had this ideology that is very similar to New Age spirituality in America right now, the law of attraction, the idea if you manifest a belief, you will get it. And they went to find that idea in the old texts. And so the first texts that come to America are all translated through this cult of people called the Theosophical Society, where Blavatsky would wake up every morning and look at the foot of her bed where there was a basket, and there would be letters from these people called the Mahatmas who were somewhere in Tibet sending her magical letters that would give her ideas about the about spirituality. They translated the Rig Veda. They translated the Tibetan Book of the Dead. They translated the Mahabharata. And that is how we got Eastern spirituality into America, through that lens.
What you've just described is audience capture for YouTubers, because I've just been writing about that for this book. I'm putting out a book next year about the psychology of secrets, and one chapter is about YouTubers have to keep inventing like sort of new secrets about themselves to reveal, so that they're constantly having to find more stuff, and you end up having to go for more and more crazy. I mean, there's loads of YouTubers who've gone down that path, and they end up going insane in search of not enlightenment, but what's going to work with, sure. You know? And so what you've just described are these people who are going off, and they've got to come back with something, and it's got to be more and more. That kind of stress, it's so funny to think that cycle has been going on for centuries and centuries.
Totally, absolutely. And for all you listeners, go check out my YouTube channel, which will be linked down below in the description, scottcarney.com, where I talk about all this stuff, and I go crazy, so you'll be great. You'll feel right at home.
You do. You talk brilliantly about it all, actually. I was watching you talk about, firstly, Kanker Source, but Wim Hof as well. And I was going to bring that up earlier, actually, but I don't know much about the whole Wim Hof thing. People go mad for Wim Hof. If anyone who doesn't know, he's the Iceman and all about being in cold places and stuff. But it was really interesting how you were saying it works really, really well at the beginning, and it does start to wear off once you've been doing it for years and years, and you've got to keep going and keep pushing. And it just sounded like so many of these other kinds of, whether it be enlightenment, whether it be a YouTuber or whatever, we get ourselves into these cycles where our bodies seem to adjust. I just talked about my nose spray. It's another example of that. Like, at first it just sort of clears my nose a bit, and then I've got to use a bit more and a bit more and a bit more. It just feels like part of the human condition, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah. It's what I call the law of speedy gains, right? Which is also the law of diminishing returns. Something helps you at first, and then it sort of tapers off. And what you need to do is get the gain and then leave when it starts to taper and do other things. And your nose spray addiction is part of this. And, you know, we could probably have a off-air conversation on how to work with that, because I do a lot of breath work now, because I was the first person to find Wim Hof. I wrote a New York Times bestseller about him. I was the reason why he got famous.
Does he thank you? No, he doesn't.
Oh, no, he certainly doesn't. In fact, he's trying to take all of my YouTube channel off the internet because I'm about to release...
Shut up.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're all attacking me and it's insane. It's totally insane. Check out my video, It's Mine, Not Whims, which is now, I think, only on Rumble, because I was hit with 10 false copyright strikes by Anum Hoff, who's Wim Hof's son, who hates me because I'm starting to tell the truth. And I should have an article out I don't know when you're airing this video, but I have a video coming out
soon.
Very soon, with... Yeah, actually, maybe it's going to come out in the same time that this video comes out, which is all about how Wim Hof, when I initially wrote about him, I was like, he's not a cult. This stuff works, because it does work. But now there's a whole bunch of people who are dead because of the Wim Hof method. And there's a huge lawsuit against him. And I'm about to release all of the information about how Wim Hof method actually might be a cult. So... Coming soon on YouTube, scottcarney.com, whatever. I don't even know what my channel is.
I'll put a link to that in the description, as well as your channel in general. I'll put a link to that video. What's one example of someone who died from it?
A lot of people are drowning because of the Wim Hof method, because Wim Hof continues to teach that you should hyperventilate in water, which is a well-known, very, very dangerous thing to do. And even though he knows it's killing people, he continues to do it. He actually emailed me, he even messaged me 10 minutes before we got on this conversation, saying that 20,000 people die every year from drowning. Why? This is just one person. So why do we care, basically? It's a real problem because people start to believe their shit. They start to look, you get to the isolated point where everyone says you're so great. You figured something out. You defied science. And some of that's true about Wim, but it's just a sliver. Right, the guy is still crazy, and it's interesting to see the rise from somebody who was like pretty genuine and humble at the beginning turn into something which is now millions of people are following. There's Goop, Joe Rogan, like he's on all of the podcasts, and he has a movie coming out about him, and now how he is isolated and believes all his own stuff. And I think it's maybe it's an inevitable thing with fame, where you know, anyone who gets too famous, again, they have to invent new things. They have to sort of push the boundaries, and they just want that affirmation. And the thing is, we don't produce groundbreaking stuff at the rate that YouTube wants it, right? We don't, we're not, life is a slow process. And the demands on people are probably too much.
That's why you need an interview show, I think, because if people who are just trying to produce stuff that's either about themselves in particular, that's very dangerous.
Right.
But also just like, you know, here's a new idea I've got and so on. Whereas I just get to people comment on YouTube and they say, hey, you should interview Scott Carney. Somebody said that. And I went,
cool.
Oh, okay. I'll email him. I didn't have to sort of go, what can I make up and invent from out of nowhere? So it's fortunately it doesn't have quite the same cycle with the audience, you know, that audience capture, but I can certainly see how it can happen.
Sure. Well, in my case, what I did is I have 5 books out before I decided to start my YouTube channel. So I'm crunching through that. I'm crunching through 20 years of material, but eventually I'll get to that point where I'll be like, yeah, I got nothing anymore. And I hope I'm
start interviewing people.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's what I'll do.
Thank you, Scott Carney, for coming on the podcast. Make sure to get The Enlightenment Trap. Check out his YouTube channel as well. Just search for Scott Carney. Look at his other books as well. Really interesting. Interesting, lovely guy. And I'm going to get him back on the podcast at some point, I think, probably to talk about some of that organ trafficking and all of that stuff. So very edgy, edge-like content. As I said, coming up on the podcast, there are episodes on sex trafficking and another one on revenge porn. We're moving a little away from some of the Scientology-like and Royals stuff just to mix up the podcast. Hope you guys enjoy that change for the next week or two, and we'll see what comes after that. I don't know yet. Do support the podcast if you're enjoying it on patreon.com/AndrewGold. You get a Saturday episode as well, bonus episode, and also all of these episodes are ad-free. Well, I think that's all I've got to say, really. Have a lovely time of it, whatever you're up to.